Heterodorks. Heteroduck storks.
Hello, TERFs and trannies. I am Nina Paley, your Heterodorks co-host.
And I am Corinna Cohn, your unimpressive co-host.
And we did not get to say hello, TERFs and trannies, during the Drager Wright debate that we recently hosted. It is on YouTube, but we also promised to make it an episode of Heterodorks. So here we are. We had a pre-arranged format for the debate. Alice Drager requested a formal timed structure, and that is what we had. It is absolutely atypical for Heterodorks, but it's what we did.
That sounds apologetic.
Well, someone was disappointed, I learned, and said that if it was representative of Heterodorks, they're very, what word did she use? Was it disappointed or unimpressed? Yes, very unimpressed. But it's not remotely typical of Heterodorks. We've never done that format before, nor have we ever done a live one before. So the way that we talk now is closer to representative, but really this is a non-representative sample of Heterodorks, but it is a debate between Alice Drager and Colin Wright. The claim they were debating was one that Colin posted on Twitter. It was biological sex is real, immutable, and binary. And when Colin posted that, Alice posted, oh, I really want to debate Colin. And then I busted in and said, we'll host a debate. And then it happened.
That's true. I was out of town when that happened. And I was completely shocked when I saw that come across my Twitter.
Yep.
And it's like when a bird lands on your finger. And I was like, uh-oh, if I react, something will happen. I better keep as still as possible.
So we all consented to this. We all made it happen. And I guess we should just play it, eh?
Are we live?
We are live.
Well then, hello everyone. Welcome to the much anticipated debate between Alice Drager and Colin Wright. The claim in dispute is, quote, biological sex is real, immutable, and binary. Colin will argue in support and Alice against.
Alice Drager, PhD, is a writer of books, articles, and essays, and a professional historian. Drager's best known book is Galileo's Middle Finger, which argues that the pursuit of evidence is the most important ethical imperative of our time. Colin Wright is an evolutionary biologist, writer, contributing editor for Quillette, and an academic advisor to the Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine. He is the founding editor of Reality's Last Stand, a publication focusing on gender ideology and the science of sex differences.
Alice Drager will begin tonight's debate. She will lay out her case for 5 minutes. Then Colin will have up to 5 minutes to respond. And then Alice will have up to 3 minutes to respond to Colin's response. And then we will flip and Colin will do the same and Alice will respond. Later, Corinna and I will ask some questions. And after that, if all goes well, we can shift to informal conversation. So, without further ado, Alice Drager.
Thanks for having us tonight. I appreciate both of you. I'm just going to set my stopwatch so that I can keep an eye on time. So sex is real, binary, and immutable. I don't think Colin and I are going to dispute that the physical universe is real, so I'm going to skip that one. With regard to immutable, I need to know what Colin is narrowing down to in terms of sex to think about whether or not it's immutable. But I think we're both going to agree that things in the past can't be changed, unfortunately. So I don't think we're going to dispute that very much. So I want to hone in on sex as binary. So let's look at real biology, because Colin cares about biology, as do I. My PhD is in history and philosophy of science. I am a science geek. So if we think about sex being binary, usually by that people point to one of two things, either chromosomes or gametes. So with regard to chromosomes, I just want to think about that for a second. So normally, if you're going to have a female develop, you'll have XX chromosomes, male XY. in the absence of something called the SRY gene on the Y chromosome, you'll get female development. And that means in utero, you get a wash of particular types of female typical hormones, you get female genital development, female brain development, blah, blah, blah. If you have that Y chromosome with that SRY gene, you get the male typical development. But there are, in fact, XX males in the world. And the reason there are XX males is because the SRY gene can actually be translocated onto an X chromosome. You can also have XY females. You can have a person who has XY chromosomes but a malfunctioning SRY, and in that case, she'll develop as a female. You can also have people with Klinefelter syndrome, which is XXY chromosomes. You can also, of course, have people with mosaic chromosomes, which is really interesting. So in some of their cells, they may have XX, and other cells, XY. You can actually have multiple types, too, three or four types of sex chromosome types in your cells. Sex is wonderfully varied in humans, and if we want to pay attention to biology, I say let's do that, but let's not pretend that biology is as simple as just providing two options in terms of things. So now let's talk about gametes. So for gametes, egg and a sperm are obviously needed to produce a human offspring, but there's lots going on in human reproduction besides eggs and sperm, and it's worth thinking about those things. So if you have an egg and a sperm, in the absence of everything else, you don't get a baby, right? You have to have hormonal systems that specifically support that egg and that sperm. You have to have genitals that allow you to get that egg to that sperm. You have to have sexual attraction. You have to have sexual arousal. So there has to be a lot more going on in the body than just eggs and sperm. And those other parts of sex matter too. But along those lines, those things can also vary. So some girls and women are born with testes but develop as pretty female typical. They have testes inside. They have complete androgen insensitivity syndrome, and we can talk about what that means. But those folks, it's worth remembering, have no responses to androgens. That means I believe in myself to be a typical female. That means those girls and women actually have less androgenized brains than I do. They have less body hair than I do. They have less effective androgens than I do. So to call them male would be a little bit strange. You can also have boys and men born with severe forms of congenital adrenal hyperplasia, in which case they'll have eggs and ovaries inside, but they won't be able to reproduce as females, not without a huge amount of medical intervention that would be something like a sex change operation and a lot of sexual hormone replacement. So you can also have somebody who has both ovarian and testicular tissue, ovotestes, or separate ovarian and testicular tissue. You could have a person born with gonadalagenesis, in which case they don't form any gonads, essentially have just streak tissue when they're born. You know, Lance Armstrong, when he had his testes out, did he stop being a male? I don't think so. I'm postmenopausal. I know because I had my mustache waxed off today, as I do once a month nowadays. Did I stop being female? No, I don't think so. So why pick gametes only? I don't think it makes a lot of sense to do so. And actually, the choice to do that reminds me a lot of what I studied for my dissertation. Physicians and also surgeons and doctors and researchers, scientists who in the late 19th century really wanted to hone in on figuring out the difference between male and female and to claim there was only a binary. And the reason they needed to do this was because socially there was challenges. Thanks, Nina. Socially there was challenges to the system. Women were demanding the right to vote, the right to property. People were starting to couple in terms of same-sex attraction. Physicians tried at that time to say that there was only a male and a female, and they pointed to gonadal tissue to try to divide it that way. It didn't work. You know, nature throws up a lot of variation. If what we're going to do is try to figure out socially, culturally, politically, what to do with a situation where we have blending, where we have folks crossing in various ways, we have to deal with that without just simply pointing to biology and saying it solves the problem for us, because it doesn't simply solve the problem for us. Thanks.
Great. Now Colin has up to 5 minutes to respond.
Yeah, thanks for outlining that. It's really interesting. I like a lot of what you said, and some things I'll have some disagreements with. I think there's a misconception that goes into what a lot of people mean when they talk about what biological sex is. And I think where you're coming from is sort of the medical aspect, like when doctors are trying to actually classify an individual, like, is this individual a male or a female? And bodies can be enormously complex things. So I certainly don't say that people's bodies are binary and that everyone who's ever lived and currently lives can just be like binary classified as either male or female. Really what I mean when I talk about biological sex is that it's composed of two parts. There's only male and female sexes, and people can sort of express those to varying you know, they can either be male or female. They can be, maybe if they're hermaphroditic, they can be both. Maybe if they're truly ambiguous, they can be neither. But the important part is that what defines an individual's sex is how their the gametes, their primary reproductive organs, are organized around through development to produce. So there can only really be two sexes that an individual can be, but that doesn't mean that every individual who's ever existed can be unambiguously categorized as being 100% either male or female. That's kind of where I'm coming from on this whole point of view. I think that, you know, we have this system where sex is also, in addition to describing biological reality of people, you know, it's also a legal category that we have in society. And so this has forced a lot of physicians and doctors to try to squeeze every single individual into one of these two categories. And sometimes I think people can really just straddle the line. There are edge cases that maybe aren't either male or female, or, you know, I haven't seen any convincing cases in humans where a person is like truly, you know, hermaphroditic, where they can produce both, you know, functionally. But in that case, it'd be someone who's both male and female. And just the nature of how we're talking about that being neither male or female or both male or female, that demonstrates the sex binary that I'm talking about, where it's really just being composed of two parts, sort of in a zoomed out way. So I think we can definitely talk about whether or not physicians should have more categories, if we should legally recognize intersex people on their IDs. In some places we do. And I think that's kind of where it boils down to. I mean, this idea that chromosomes also are what define an individual's sex, I think this sort of also muddles the water a little bit with the distinction between what determines an individual's sex, whether it's chromosomes or with reptiles, it's temperature, and what defines an individual's sex. So we're talking about the definition of sex. We're really talking about the type of gonads they have, what they're organized around to produce, whether or not they're ever functional. But when we're talking about whether sex is determined in terms of a determining mechanism, so this is sort of a developmental concept that is related to how certain tissues begin certain down a developmental pathway. So we would say that, you know, in humans and other mammals, we have chromosomal sex determination. That just means all the genes that really send individuals down certain pathways, male or female, are harbored on certain sex chromosomes. For reptiles, for many of them, they have temperature-dependent sex determination, where the temperature that they're incubating depends, you know, triggers the switch of what sort of developmental trajectory they'll go down. We wouldn't say that we define the sex of an alligator by their temperature. It's defined by, you know, sort of their primary reproductive organs, but their sex is determined, you know, developmentally by this process of whether it's heat, whether it's chromosomes, etc. So I think there's maybe a little bit of clarification needed there. Also things like hormones, secondary sex characteristics, these are all sort of components of one sex. These are markers of an individual's sex, but they don't really define an individual's biological sex in sort of a universal, rigorous way. These are just sort of influenced by either chromosomally they determine sex developmentally, or they're a consequence of one sex, such as when someone goes through puberty. So that's sort of my issue with this strict, I guess, medicalization way that we're going about defining sex, or that you are. So I guess I'll leave it there for now.
Yeah, I don't think I was using a medical approach to sex. I was using examples that physicians have discovered, but these are real biological cases, just as is the case for the more typical female and the more typical pathway. I think basically Colin just agreed that sex is not binary. And so maybe we don't disagree about anything, because I think he just agreed that sex is not binary. He said that we have to think about the gametes and the organs that are organized to produce them, but acknowledge that there is lots of variation within that, that there's different developmental pathways that can occur, that there are variations that can occur within those developmental pathways. Indeed, acknowledge that, you know, there are people who fit outside of the binary enough that we're not even sure how to think about categorizing them as male or female when we insist on having two categories, as we do, for example, for the law. And of course, the law doesn't have to approach things this way. We could have different ways to approach the law. So I think basically he just acknowledged that sex is not simply binary, that most people fall into one of two general pools, but that a lot of people don't, and that there is variation in the world. So, okay.
All right, then. Colin, It is your turn. This is your 5-minute presentation. Okay. Let's go.
Okay, I'm going to go a little quick here because I have written stuff down here. So I'm defending the position that biological sex is real, binary, and immutable in humans. So starting off, is sex real? Yes, I think this is extremely uncontroversial, given that we wouldn't be here having this conversation or debate were it not for the fact that we come from a sperm and an egg being fertilized by a male and a female. And males and females are defined by, you know, the type of gamete that their primary reproductive organs are organized around through development to produce. So is sex binary? So I suspected this would be sort of where the bulk of our disagreement is going to reside. So let me first make it clear what sex is binary does not mean. So when I say sex is binary, I do not mean that every human being who has ever existed and ever will exist can perfectly and unambiguously be classified as either male or female, even if the overwhelmingly vast majority can't. What I'm saying is that there are only two sexes. Binary here means composed of two parts, sort of the way we might talk about a binary star system or a binary compound in chemistry, something like that. Because there are only two types of gametes or sex cells that a person's primary reproductive anatomy can be organized around to produce, there are therefore only two sexes that a person can be. But what about hermaphrodites, or so-called intersex people with ambiguous anatomy? Well, the existence of hermaphrodites in any species, not just humans, doesn't invalidate the binary nature of sex. Remember, we're just saying it's composed of two parts. And neither does the existence of people with ambiguous sexual anatomy. That's because instead of being additional sexes to male and female, hermaphrodites are both male and female. A person who has ambiguous anatomy may be neither male nor female, but the categories both male and female, or neither male nor female, are not themselves sexes. In fact, the words both and neither with respect to sex and these types of individuals demonstrates the binary nature of sex. Now, the way I'm talking about sex, it's not like my personal choice. It's sort of a universal definition that applies to every sexual reproducing anisogamous species, including plants. So trying to define males and females by the appearance of their external genitalia, their chromosomes, their hormones, secondary sex characteristics, this conflates markers of sex with sex itself, which I would say is a category error. So is sex immutable? Yes, I would say sex is immutable. Like other aspects of one's biology, such as, you know, maybe your race or the species that you are, mammals are characterized by the presence of mammary glands in the females that produce milk, the presence of fur, other traits that in combination describe mammals. But, you know, a reptile like a monitor lizard can't be made into a mammal or more mammal by removing its scales and doing hair transplants and, you know, surgically adding mammary glands and things like that. We would need a time machine to go back and, you know, just do some gene editing to have sex be sort of mutable in that sense. And I'll finish with why I think this is actually a really important question. I believe it's really important to be clear about what sex is and what isn't. That's because we're living at a time where many activists are trying to dismiss categories of male and female entirely as a social construct so that they can replace sex with self-proclaimed gender identity across the board in law. But in some contexts, I think that acknowledging a person's sex is really important. The activist line of argumentation goes something like this. Sex is binary because intersex people exist. Their existence demonstrates biological sex is a spectrum. Since sex is a spectrum, that means that no line can be clearly drawn separating males and females. If we can't draw a line, then anywhere someone decides to draw a line is totally arbitrary. If it's totally arbitrary, that means the categories male and female are also arbitrary or social constructs with no basis in reality. If that's the case, why are we categorizing people with these arbitrary labels? We should therefore instead just to let people label themselves. Now, I'm not committing a slippery slope fallacy here. This is just how the game is currently being played with, I would say, devastating consequences for women's rights and protections. And it's also, I think, confusing kids. Just because there may be edge cases where intersex people evade a clear either or classification doesn't mean we all evade classification to some degree. And I think this is perhaps my largest disagreement with some of Alice's work. So in her book, Hermaphrodites, she argued this point, and I'll just give a quote. She said, "Hermaphroditism causes a great deal of confusion, more than one might first appreciate, because as we'll see again and again, the discovery of a hermaphroditic body raises doubts, not just about the particular body in question, but about all bodies. The questioned body forces us to ask what exactly it is, if anything, that makes the rest of us unquestionable. No, I think that's really good writing. I also think that it's not totally true. So just because some people may be edge cases doesn't mean everyone's sex is in question to some degree. I think the overwhelming vast majority of people are totally unambiguously male or female. And I think it's important to acknowledge that aspect of reality.
Thank you. Alice has 5 minutes to respond.
So I think that sloppy thinking by activists is not actually solved by sloppy thinking by PhDs. It is true that some activists have this really sloppy approach where they say that just because we can't figure out where to draw the line, there are no lines possible to be drawn. We can, of course, restrict social spaces. We can make decisions to restrict who can marry who. We can make decisions to restrict who can use what bathroom. We can make decisions to restrict who has access to particular forms of health insurance based on what a male gets in their health insurance or a female gets in her health insurance, right? We can make all of these decisions, but these decisions are ultimately going to be social and political and cultural decisions. They may point to biology, but at the end of the day, biology doesn't solve them in a simple way for us. The book that you're quoting from, the actual title of the book is not Hermaphrodites. It's Hermaphrodites and the Medical Invention of Sex. And I specifically was tracing in that book the way that 19th century physicians and scientists were desperately trying to point to a clear division line between male and female because they were faced with difficult situations socially and culturally. There were women challenging the borders that had been put around them. And those borders had put around them with the claim that those were sex borders, that those borders were necessary because they had gone all the way back to the moment when evolution split the male and the female. And that is why women could not have college educations. And that was why women could not own property. And that's why women couldn't vote. There were also at the same time in the late 19th century, people who had started what would eventually become the gay rights movement, the attempts to actually be allowed to couple together as same-sex people. And physicians were very conservative in responding to that and trying to figure out a way to divide people very carefully. Ironically, as I trace in the book, this is actually in medicine where the concept of gender comes from. It didn't come from a radical left point of view where people were trying to say that sex doesn't matter. It actually came from the fact that physicians were facing women who were very womanly women, who were attracted to men, who were discovered to have testes inside. That freaked the doctors out. The doctors were also looking at cases where people were clearly operational in society as adult humans, presenting as either male or female, but had ovotestes inside. And what they had to do was figure out a way to say, that biology doesn't really matter. We're just going to keep everybody organized the way they appear to be at the surface. And that's actually when they created gender around 1915. One of the chapters in that book is about that. It was actually a rearguard attempt to stop a situation where biology was confusing us. And the fear on the part of doctors and scientists was that if the populace understood just how confusing biology was, they would begin to become confused about those social and political categories. So it was really a rearguard action to that and an attempt to stop these kinds of things. I think, you know, the idea that somehow we're confusing children and that things are complicated, we certainly need to teach kids about the biology of their bodies. And it's something I've advocated strongly for from the time of birth, that we need to start teaching children the right names for their parts, how their parts work, telling them the truth about how parts work, how sex works. But I think we can do that without having to sort of panic and decide that we can't really acknowledge that there's lots of variation in human experience as well as human body types. I am not simply whatever gametes I produce. Before I produced eggs that were viable in terms of actually being able to mother somebody, after I've been able to do that, I think of myself still as a female because I've had a life of experience as well as having a biological type that sort of makes sense in terms of that category. I don't think we have to be quite so afraid of people throwing up challenges to these things and biology showing us that actually life is a lot more complicated than we had given it credit for in the past. Basically, I've heard Colin saying again that things are more complicated than just two types, that in fact, we have more than two types. But he says, but we don't have to pay attention to those things on the edges. Well, I think we do have to pay attention to those things on the edges if what we're talking about is biology, if what we're talking about is making social and cultural and political decisions to keep people out of certain things. Let's use rationality and let's use reasonable arguments to do that. But let's not pretend nature does that for us. Nature doesn't simply solve that question for us. Thanks, Nina.
Okay. And now Colin has up to 3 minutes to respond. 3 minutes.
So I certainly acknowledge all of the variation that we have. And I'm not saying we need to skirt intersex people or people who have hermaphroditic properties under the rug. Not at all. Like I'm fully aware that these people exist. What I'm saying that I think is maybe where we're talking past each other is that their existence doesn't undermine the binary nature of sex. Because remember, I think what's being conflated here is I'm not saying that everyone can be unambiguously categorically assigned to two and only two boxes called male and female. Okay, that's something that physicians do with bodies, and bodies are very complex. What I'm saying is that a person who's a hermaphrodite, or any species that is a hermaphrodite, this doesn't debunk the sex binary, because to be a hermaphrodite is to be both male and female, to be composed of both aspects of biological sex, both of the sexes in one body. That demonstrates that sex is a binary. That means there's perhaps three different types of individuals in a population. There's males, females, and then individuals who are both male and female. But a hermaphrodite is not a third sex. It is merely a third type of body an individual can have, where they're using both sort of reproductive strategies in one body. And a person or any animal who has sort of ambiguous genitalia or gonads or what have you, take any mix and match them however you please, they would maybe be considered neither male nor female. But again, not being male or female is not itself a third sex or a fourth sex. Okay, it's just being neither one of these two and only two categories. So intersex people exist. Hermaphroditic humans, depending on how they're defined, do exist, but they don't undermine the sex binary. Now, there was a philosopher of science. He wrote a piece for my magazine, and he had a really good way that he illustrated this. He used shoes to demonstrate the binary nature of sex. So with shoes, you can have left shoes and right shoes. So this is sort of defines the whole world of shoes, you know, that we have. But if you look at how people can be shooed, you know, you can have an individual who's wearing only a right shoe. You can have an individual who's wearing only a left shoe. You can have an individual who's wearing both right and left shoes on their feet. And you can have individuals who aren't wearing shoes at all. That doesn't mean that the world of shoes is composed of a binary thing of left and right shoes. But how individuals can be shooed can take four different things. But we wouldn't say that wearing both shoes is itself a new type of a shoe, or not wearing any shoes is its own new type of a shoe, a third or a fourth type of shoe. There's only two shoes in the shoe system, just like there's only two sexes in the sex system. Just because someone might be both or neither doesn't mean that sex isn't binary, doesn't mean that sex isn't composed of fundamentally two aspects, which is the male and female reproductive strategy defined by their how their reproductive anatomy is organized around. Okay, that's it.
Thank you both. Now it's question time. Corinna, do you have a question?
I do have one question, and I think let's change the order of the speakers. So we'll ask Colin to give the first answer, then we'll invite Alice to give the second answer. So I'd done a little bit of research in the past, and unfortunately, I couldn't find the exact paper that I was looking for, but there's a similar one that talks about the ablation of the penis after circumcision. The most famous case of this was the man who was David Reimer. But there have been other occasions of this happening in the past where boys who received cosmetic vaginoplasty as babies were raised as girls. And the long-term follow-up of these children, it is not always the case that these children revert to having a male gender identity as adults. Some of them retain, they're raised as girls, and they retain that as adults. So my question is, what is your explanation for the relationship between gender identity and biological sex?
That's a big question. I think that there is something to be said about when people are something, they kind of have an innate sense of what they are. I mean, if you were to dress a dog as a horse and put them in a pasture with other dogs and horses, they'd probably go to the dogs. They'd probably just feel more affinity with them to some degree because, you know, they are that thing. I think if we're talking about, you know, I'm not really sure how a lot of people define gender identity. A lot of times it's defined based on stereotypes of masculinity and femininity. So I think the gender identity is sort of a social phenomenon. I think people sort of look at the spread of individuals in their lives, males and females. They notice sort of patterns that are existing between these two categories, and they kind of know where they fit in relation to those sort of personality traits, mannerisms, et cetera. And so those are maybe the sort of type of stereotypes they might come to identify with, just based on sort of a combination of innate and socially constructed, you know, sex roles. I think that's what most people are probably doing. I think that in the case of, you know, individuals who have their, you know, their genitals changed or whatever, I think they're going to maintain like their identity that matches their sex in a large part because that's sort of what they are. They're also left with genitals that are have been operated on that are going to be sort of, you know, not typical for their sex. So I think there's probably a degree of, you know, not feeling like they're fully one thing or the other too. So yeah, it really comes down to like what we mean when we talk about gender identity. And I think that would have to be kind of clarified before I can give any more definitive answer, I guess.
Thanks. I'm going to make the answer time 5 minutes, if that's okay. You can do less than that, but I realize we have plenty of time. Do you want to talk for 2 more minutes, Colin? Oh, you're muted, Colin.
No, I think I'm okay. I mean, that's more of a social aspect and the relationship of like sex differences. And I think it's interesting, but you know, I wouldn't say I'm an expert on that. So okay. I'll end there.
All right. Back to Alice.
Yeah, Corinna, thank you. That's a really interesting question. And I think the work you're talking about is the work that was done by Milton Diamond and Bill Reiner on children, specifically biological males born with cloacal extrophy. So cloacal extrophy is a condition where basically the gut wall does not form in development. And it's a very dangerous condition. Children used to die of it, but with modern medicine, they don't always die. When a male is born in this way, it means their genitals basically can't form because in the womb, since the gut wall is not forming, there's no place for the penis to form. And as a consequence, when they're born, they essentially don't have male genitalia. If their life is saved through basically putting their guts back in and closing their gut wall, they lack male genitalia. So historically speaking, coming out of mostly Johns Hopkins University, this approach to intersex children was used on these kids, even though brain-wise, they're not at all intersex. They had the male typical development. Inside, they had the testes, and the testes were working in development. And when they're born, by the way, their testes are okay. And yet what happened at Hopkins was a decision that because you can't supposedly be a male without a penis, they sex changed all of these kids into females, took out their testes, rendering them without fertility, even though they would have had fertility later in life otherwise. And the follow-up was really interesting because a bunch of them turned out to revert and become self-identified as male. I mean, not in utero, they didn't self-identify, obviously, but later in life when they found out what happened to them, they were identifying as male, but not all did. And that's really interesting, right? Because it suggests to us that there's more going on in terms of gender identity than simply prenatal brain development. But we kind of knew that because brains are these really amazingly plastic things, and sex development is one of the ways in which the brain is getting a feedback loop. So we know that there are various kinds of cues in the environment that can shift the way that our brains develop. And it looks like that's even true in terms of our sexual development. So there have been some studies done, for example, of when girls begin to have their first period. And if they're in a culture that is subjecting them to sexual relationships earlier, they seem to have their periods come on earlier. This suggests to us that the body is reacting to what's going on in the culture. It's not only our brains are somehow set when we're born and they're never more changed. So it does suggest to us that there are ways in which our gender identities are not simply inborn, but may be reacting to what goes on around us in the world. And I think it is one of those places where it makes a lot of sense to think about gender identity as being distinct from a sex, a biological sex identity that has something to do with, for example, gametes or has to do with chromosomal basis, because it doesn't always match in that simple way. There are actually other kinds of intersex conditions where we see something similar. So a really interesting one is 5 alpha reductase deficiency. And that's where you have a biological male and the biological male is producing testosterone in utero. So normally you would get male genital development and you're certainly getting male brain development, but they're lacking enzyme 5 alpha reductase. And that enzyme is needed to change testosterone into dihydrotestosterone to make the genitals form male. So lacking that enzyme, their genitals form along the female pathway, even though their brains are developing along the more male typical pathway. And so when they're born, they look like girls and they're typically raised as girls. And then at puberty, those testes go into high gear and you don't need the 5 alpha reductase. So they undergo a male typical puberty. And in some of those cases, they then identify as men. But in some of those cases, they continue identifying as females, as girls or women. And so it's one of those other cases where we kind of don't know what to make of that. It's possible that if there were other gender identities available to them, they might identify as something else. But there aren't in the cultures where this has been studied. There are not those extra identities possible. I do want to talk, if we have a chance, about the phenomenon documented around the world. Thanks, Nina. Where there are biological males born who are female typical in their behaviors or more female typical in their behaviors, who are also going to grow up to be androphilic, that is attracted to other males, who are changed in the culture to grow up as girls. So I'm thinking of the Fafafine in Samoa, Paul Vasey's work. I'm thinking of the Muhe in Mexico. I think that's a really interesting category too, that suggests to us that there is natural variation within gendered, what we think of as gendered behaviors or sexed behaviors, and also in terms of sexual attraction. And there are some cultures that are sort of ready for this and have created categories to catch those children into in order to preserve, ironically, the two-sex system, right? They could raise these kids as boys and they would grow up to be gay men. But in those cultures that are fairly conservative, they shift them over to girls so that they're normalized into the female role, which includes having sex with men. And I have an article on this called The Old Way to Be Gay, if people are interested in more of that. It's a really interesting phenomenon that's found cross-culturally.
Thank you.
Okay. Whoops. Thank you. I have a question. Alice, I believe you argue for the inclusion of male-bodied people in female sports. And Colin, I assume you argue against that. Could you please each make your arguments for the inclusion or exclusion of male-bodied people in female sports? And I guess we're going to start with Alice.
Well, yeah, I'm going to... Do we need to define what male body does?
Yes, please. Thank you.
Okay, so then maybe before that, we'll have the question, what is a man?
Well, that's what we're here for, isn't it?
Okay, then. I mean, usually they say, what is a woman? Should we do that? I thought if I asked that question, that everyone would be like, oh, that's so political. What is a woman? All right, we're going to ask that first, then I'll ask the other question. Alice Drager, what is a woman?
I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I'm a historian, so I'm going to do that annoying thing where I'm going to ask you which time and which place you're talking about, and then I can define it for you, right?
Right
now.
So
let's go back to what I was just talking about, the folks who are Fafafine in Samoa. And I know of this because of the excellent work by Paul Vasey at the University of Lethbridge. So among the Fafafine, what happens in Samoa is that you have children born to the world, right? And some of those children are very male typical, and some of those children are very female typical. But there are some children born who are very obviously male. But by the time they're little kids, 3 and 4 years old, they're interested in the female typical cultural things. So they're interested in sticking close to their mothers, doing social activities that are female typical activities. They want to hang with the girls. And this is what, when I was growing up, were called sissy boys, right? These were kids who were feminine typical but male-bodied. And in Samoa, they have a system for dealing with this, which is to recognize that child as really being more like a female. And so they decide to put them in this category called Fafafine, which means in the manner of a woman. So this child is going to grow up in the manner of a woman. They dress the child as a girl, give her the girl's name, and recognize that she's going to grow up in the girl system and not in the boy system. When she grows up, she's going to want to have sex with men because they've recognized that that type of gender activity comes typically with androphilia. They've just recognized this the way people the world over, including when I was a little kid, they all recognize this. So that is they're sort of normalized into that system because when they grow up and they're having sex with men, they appear to be women. So it's not sexually disruptive. It looks like heterosexuality is preserved. It looks like the simple two-sex system is preserved. I know to us as Americans looking at that, we're like, wait a minute, what? Especially because straight men are having sex with a fafafine. And in our system, that doesn't make any sense. Because in our system, if you're going to have men having sex with men, they both have to be gay. They have to both identify as gay. But in other parts of the world, that's not how it works out. So would I say that the fafafine are living in the matter of a woman in terms of that culture? Yes. Does that mean they are women? Well, depends what you mean by a woman, right? They're obviously not going to give birth to babies. They don't have the biological system for doing that. But they're living within that system as women. When I go out into the world, you know, and ask myself the question, am I a woman? You know, are people recognizing me as a woman? I will say that people typically recognize me as a woman, but I'm putting some degree of effort into that, right? I did have my mustache waxed today. I'm wearing a little bit of makeup. My hairdresser did my hair kind of cute like a female. You know, does that mean that I could go out in the world and simply be a woman and not have all of that? Yeah, sure. But the fact is that within cultural systems, there are cues about what you're supposed to do and not do to be recognized as a woman or recognized as a man. And some of us decide to play with that. And some of us decide to reject that. And some of us decide to switch over. Those are the possibilities out there in the world around me. So what does it mean to be a woman? I guess one of the things is people always ask us what it means to be us, and men don't get asked that quite as much. I would say that about being a woman.
Okay. Colin, what is a woman?
So I have just a straightforward biological answer, because I don't really go in too much the sex role, you know, cultural aspect of things. I define a woman as an adult human female. You know, in species, we have adults, they're, you know, the ages of reaching, you know, sexual maturity. You know, in humans, we have a legal system because we realize there's, you know, maturity issues. You might reach sexual maturity, but, you know, you shouldn't be classified as an adult legally. So we can just define that as being sort of age of majority, 18 years old, as being an adult. Being a human, you're a member of the species Homo sapiens. And, you know, a female is someone who has the reproductive system that's organized around the production of large gametes. That's sort of my simple answer to it. I know that there are cultural definitions of what a woman is and what a man is, and they're based on sort of cultural norms and expectations, and they change based on time and culture and place and all that type of things. I think when we're talking about what a man and a woman is, at least in law in the United States, when we're colloquially talking about what these categories refer to, especially in the context of sports, for instance, we really all sort of do mean adult human female in these instances. Because, you know, for instance, in sports, there's no reason to categorize different leagues based on how people identify and the roles they do, whether they're masculine or feminine, any more than you need to have separate leagues for people who identify as Catholics or Protestants or Republicans or Democrats, you know. Yeah, I'll leave it there. If we want to save a second question for the sports thing, we can make those separate, I suppose. But that's, you know, I just say adult human female because I think that's probably what most people mean. But if we want to talk about areas of cultural types of things, different cultures where they define these things by social roles, that's fine too. I would just like to make that completely distinct from an individual's biological sex.
Okay, then. Now I'm going to ask the question of why exclude or include men from women's sports or males from female sports? And I guess
those are different questions.
Yeah, is it men? is it social roles we're excluding or biological? Maybe we should make sure.
Biological. My understanding of these sports categories is that they are biological category that females and males, that they are not based on social roles or identities.
Good luck with that, Nina.
Well, I'm going to have Colin argue for, I mean, actually, Colin, if you want to say that, I mean, why are sports segregated in the first place, and why do you think they should be segregated that way?
Yeah, I think that's where it kind of needs to start. Go. Sort of the normative reason that we have sex segregated leagues in the first place. And that's because males, just on average, they're bigger, faster, stronger than females. Even if you're controlling for things like height and weight and things like that, they have more upper body strength. They can throw things further. They have bigger hands, bigger grip strength, more lung capacity. And yes, while these things are sort of, there is some overlap in the performance of males and females, for instance, like there's some females who are much taller than I am. Not many, I'm pretty tall. There's a lot of women who are faster than me. I'm not very fast. But we kind of, I think, a lot of times confuse this, like, this general overlap that we see. Everyone knows, like, a really strong woman or a really weak guy, short guy like this. So we always think that maybe there can be some meaningful competition. And for some categories, it might be. Maybe for children of certain ages, they can compete with each other, and it's more or less fair. And there are sex differences early on. But really, once you hit puberty, like, the sex differences just sort of really explode. And so this is why we have different categories based on biological sex. Now, an interesting thing what we need to say is I think there's a difference between the biological sex that an individual is and what category they might necessarily be is more reasonable for them to compete in. I think a lot of leagues have an intersex policy for some of these categories because, you know, there's big debates about Caster Semenya because she had that 5-ARD intersex condition. And, you know, because of the male puberty that they go through, they're very androgenized. You know, I would say that they have an advantage. I would say they're also biologically male and shouldn't compete in female sports. We can take another case. What about, you know, people with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome? I would say from like a zoomed out, pure like biological perspective, given that they have testes, they're biologically male. Should they compete in male sports? I would probably say no. I would say that for the sake of fairness in sports, their sports sex, it might make sense to classify them as females, even though there is sort of an advantage, even though their bodies aren't responding to testosterone whatsoever, they are sort of overrepresented in women's sports. So I think people could probably disagree with that if they wanted to. I think each individual league should have an intersex policy that makes sense, that is basically protecting the women's category because, you know, only the women need to have a protected category because once you're talking about elite sports, for instance, you just don't find any females who are, you know, going to be making it into the NBA, who are, you know, at the top 0.01% of ability. If you just open these categories, anyone who identifies into these things, you're not going to have women's sports. You're just not. It's going to be all men all the time. And so an intersex policy is really important to have, and people can debate about where exactly that line should be drawn. But that's different from a trans policy because a trans policy, you know, a trans woman who's biologically male competing in the woman's category, you know, there's nothing ambiguous about this person's sex that, say, someone with androgen insensitivity or Caster Semenya, they might be sort of a debatable individual. I would say that the people who are just unambiguously male, I don't think they should compete in female sports because that's the reason female sports exist in the first place, to sort of control for these intense androgenizing effects of male puberty. So that's my case.
Okay. Now, Alice.
So I've discovered a lot of weirdness in sports. I'm not actually somebody who follows sports generally, although I run and I swim and I bike for my own stress levels. I don't usually follow sports. But once I started studying what the IOC was doing and got invited to consult with the IOC, I discovered there's a lot of mischief that occurs in elite sports. So, for example, Colin, you said that there's no sports where sort of females can outdo males. But in fact, ski jumping is one of the few sports where females actually can outcompete males. And fascinatingly, the International Olympic Committee kept ski jumping male only for many years because they didn't want a situation where females were actually outdoing males. So it's another good example of the way that we define categories based on what we're trying to achieve, not what biology really presents us. But, you know, this question of should we divide sports in terms of sex categories, to my mind, what we're really getting down to is hormonal categories. So we know that the reason that males on average outcompete females has everything to do with hormones. And as I've told Nina and Corinna on a previous episode, I have no problem with the idea of hormonal classes, just like I have no problem with the idea of weight classes in wrestling. And I have no problem with the idea even of age classes or those kinds of things. But I think we should just be honest that what we're talking about is not gender. What we're talking about is hormonal history and hormonal present. And we should if we want to pay attention to that, I have no problem with it. It's a biological difference that clearly matters in terms of performance. But let's just be honest that what we're talking about is hormones, not whether or not you are a woman or a man. Because of the fact that you have women with CIAS, AIS, for example, who are less androgenized than I am, competing in sports. And it would make no sense, for example, to say just because they have a Y chromosome in testes, they count as male. Colin agreed with this. It makes sense to count them as female. Therefore, it makes sense to me to just talk about hormonal classes and figure out what should go into those hormonal classes. If we end up wanting to call them women's sports and men's sports, I suppose we can do that, but we should not pretend that we're talking about something other than hormonal classes. If people want to divide in those ways, I think that's okay. When I do triathlons, for example, I'm divided not just into the female category, but I'm also divided into an age class. And that's because that way I don't have to compete against 20-year-old women. So that I have a shot at getting a medal. And that's why it's divided in that way, in order to encourage people to participate in sports and to have a shot at getting a medal. And I get that. I understand that sports is meant to be participatory and there are ways in which we can make it happen. I want to use an example, again, going back to Lance Armstrong. I don't know if you all know this, but Lance Armstrong actually has what's called a therapeutic use exemption. And this is something that elite sports allow certain people to have for taking testosterone. Normally, testosterone is considered a doping drug. But for people like Lance Armstrong, who have had to be castrated, essentially, they're allowed to get a therapeutic use exemption and take testosterone, which nobody else in the normal class would be allowed to do in the male class. Men with Klinefelter syndrome have lower levels of testosterone. They can get therapeutic use exemptions. I confirmed this with WADA when I was doing this research. It's really interesting. So they'll allow the men to dope up with testosterone, but they won't allow the women to do it because the claim is testosterone is somehow a male drug. Well, that's not true. I make testosterone. Everybody here makes testosterone. What's really going on is that we've got a division into hormonal classes. So that's really the big division going on here. And, you know, when we think about this stuff, I think it's important to just recognize what it is we're really talking about and not let it slip all over the place. The thing that shocked me the most when I was at the IOC, there was this elite woman marathoner there, and she confessed that she manipulates birth control pills in order to make sure that she's at the maximum point of her cycle in order to compete. And I asked her afterwards, like, do you all do this? And she said, yes, we all do it. Women across the spectrum manipulate hormonal birth control in order to get their hormones at the right point so that they can compete maximally in their sport. Well, once I learned that, I was like, this is just a stupid game, right? We're pointing at trans people. We're pointing at intersex people. And we're like, you can't do this because your hormones don't fit. Oh, come on. Let's just be honest. Everybody's playing with these hormones in these elite sports. They're getting caught some of the time. They're allowed some of the time. But if what we're going to do is create these hormonal classes, let's be honest about it and tell everybody what everybody's had historically and what they're getting now. And then I think it would feel more honest to me. It would just feel more honest than saying that somehow trans people are exceptional and intersex people are exceptional, when it turns out a lot of people are exceptional in elite sports for a lot of different reasons in terms of what they can get access to and what they're using.
All right. Should we just have informal discussion now? I would like in the 10 minutes that Alice has left, I would like it if
I wanted to ask Colin a question.
Colin could converse.
Can I ask Colin a question?
Oh, yeah, that sounds great.
Absolutely.
So Colin mentioned, now I don't remember where I wrote this down, but you said something like, you know, you define a woman as an adult human female. So when I went to one of the support group meetings for the androgen sensitivity syndrome support group, it includes women with partial androgen and men with partial androgen insensitivity syndrome, and then women also with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome. I met a woman there, actually she and her sister, as I recall, who were both in their 70s. And this woman that I was talking with did not find out until she was in her 70s that she had androgen insensitivity syndrome. Her husband was a physician and he knew. And her own physician knew, but they both lied to her and didn't tell her that she had complete androgen insensitivity syndrome. So she had only just found out. Are you telling me that she's not a woman? Because she's not a female in the conventional sense. She has testes. She has a Y chromosome. Is she not a woman? Was her whole life a lie?
I don't know if her whole life, I would say her whole life is a lie, but if I'm just being literal, adhering to the biological factors, I would say that biologically this person is not a woman, but socially and legally, that I think they should get all of those rights and call them women. I'd be happy to refer to them one as one. I probably wouldn't even know the difference. But if I'm talking about, do I literally believe they're a woman? I don't. But
so
I
then you're just
really
collapsing,
matters.
Right? You're just collapsing the word woman to mean female. It has no meaning in and of itself.
No, woman, I mean, it's an adult human female. So, I mean, I think there could be some areas where there's a social courtesy involved where you can, you know, refer to people outside a category that you literally believe is true. I think for all intents and purposes, socially wise, legally wise, even perhaps medically wise, depending on the type of procedure, I'm perfectly fine referring to this individual as a woman, even though if I don't literally believe that that is true. But I don't think that's is really a contradiction there. I think it's...
So even though her brain was less androgenized than mine, her body was less androgenized than mine.
Yeah, I don't define...
You don't think she's a woman? You don't think she belongs in the women's bathroom or doesn't belong to... She should not get an award for a woman's book writing? Tell me about that. Or her life is just a fiction.
Well, I don't think
she's not really a woman.
Well, I don't think the androgenization of a brain determines whether someone's a woman. I think their biological sex is involved in determining whether they're a woman. I think it makes sense for this individual to use women's bathrooms. Again, I said the social wise, the legal wise, I think they should have every legal and social protection that women have, because for all intents and purposes, socially, the way we're going to look at people, that's sort of what they certainly appear as, you know, on the surface. But if I'm just asked as a scientist, is this person a woman? If I'm defining what a woman is as an adult human female, then no. But I don't think that really has social consequences, because I'm happy to refer to them as a woman socially in almost every context that it would matter, including sports and what bathrooms they're using and all these types of things. So that's...
Well, I know we're short on time, so I would like to at least get this one question out. I've been listening to both of your points. I don't know if this is helpful, but given that we're talking about adult humans, just given that, is there any trait that an adult human might have that would disqualify them from the category of woman?
Is there any, say that one more time?
Is there any quality or property that is innate to a person, to an adult human, that would disqualify them from the category woman?
I mean, I would say being biologically male would.
What specifically?
Specifically, the type of their gonads, what it comes down to. But again, if individuals can have ambiguous gonads and what have you, just because some individuals are ambiguous doesn't mean everyone's a little bit ambiguous. But I think, you know, we can have debates on the edge cases of, is this person qualify as being a woman or not based on a definition, you know, a biological definition. But just because there are hard cases doesn't mean that every case is a hard case, and the vast majority are not. But we need to deal with the hard cases as they arise. And I think people can probably come to different conclusions on certain individuals.
I'm going to go with Martin Luther King Jr. I'm going to say that we should judge people on the basis of their behavior, the way they treat other people, and not on the basis of their skin color or their skin shape or their gonadal type or their chromosomal basis. Yeah, I mean, I think if we want to do things like divide sports into hormonal classes, we can certainly do that. If we want to create social and political divisions, we can certainly do that. But we should not blame biology for our own stupid decisions. We can be informed about biology, but I don't want to blame biology. So I think really, you know, to Corinna's question, when Colin answers it's the gonads, I'm like, oh my God, really? So a woman with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome somehow is male by that definition. And that makes no sense to me. And we can talk about how the edge cases are hard and we don't have to think about the edge cases. Maybe it's because I have lived my life with the people considered to be worth ignoring, that I think about those things and think these things directly impact them, directly impact the way that they are seen, the decisions that parents are making about what to do to their children's bodies and their upbringing because of the social and cultural pressures brought upon them. You know, I'm trying to think a lot about the effects on humanity of the claims that we're making. And that's where I get really nervous about making these kinds of claims that we can somehow define a woman. I do think it's worth having women's spaces and these kinds of things. They've been very important in my life, but I'm not going to kid myself into somehow thinking that if I create a woman's bathroom and decide to keep out a whole bunch of a certain number of people because they have certain biological aspects, either presently or in their history, that I'm going to be totally safe in a woman's bathroom. I have been abused in women's bathrooms by natal females enough to know that you don't solve the problems of behavior by simply pointing to biology and insisting everybody behave according to particular biological types. I think what we have to pay attention to is whether or not people treat each other well and judge them on the basis of that. And if we what we want to do is create sports categories and judge them on the basis of having particular strength or particular age or particular hair or particular brain types, then we can do that. Absolutely. We can play with those kinds of things and recognize those as play that refer back to biology. But biology, at the end of the day, isn't where we live. Where we live is in this integrated experience of biology and the world around us, and we interact with each other. And that, to me, is where meaning exists.
I will largely agree with a lot of what you said, for sure. I mean, I don't want to reduce people as a whole down to the types of gonads that they have, like as a person. Like biologically, they might be male or female, one thing, but you know, that's sex certainly doesn't matter if you're going to be my friend, if I'm, you know, friend shopping. It shouldn't matter if you're getting, considered for a raise. It really, there's actually very few categories, very few contexts that sex should matter. Most contexts, it really shouldn't. We should all just be treating each other as individuals and, you know, what types of things do you like, you know, your hobbies, your interests, how good of a person you are, shared beliefs, all those things. Like, that's what makes people, like, that's what makes a life. But we can still distinguish the fact that there are some contexts, at least I think, that where sex does matter. I think sports is one of those contexts, I think. And perhaps prisons and bathrooms and things like that. People can debate about what are the more important ones. But I do think it comes down to sort of this difference between, you know, defining an individual based on their gonads as a whole versus, you know, in these certain contexts, these differences matter. They're informative for background rates. And it doesn't have to be completely clear cut. I mean, I even said that I think people with complete androgen insensitivity syndrome should be able to compete in the women's category, for instance. There's concessions I can make between sort of the legal aspect of being a male or female legally that can differ from sort of the biological aspect. So I agree with the Martin Luther King thing. We need to treat people as individuals, content of their character, all that stuff. But I do think there are instances where the sex of the individual does matter. And for most people, it is clear cut. You know, there's a very small percentage of people where there's even going to be a debate about what this person is.
We know that Alice has a hard stop at 7 o'clock. You both came with good faith. I could tell that you listened to each other, responded to each other in good faith. These are the sorts of conversations that we ought to be having more of.
Thank you,
Alice. I thank you for being here so much. I know you've got that hard stop, we do want to have some sort of discussion after this with at least Nina and I. Colin, you're welcome to sit in, but Alice, I hope you don't feel that you won't have a chance to respond to anything. So we're not going to nitpick or cherry pick any of your arguments, but we do want to at least take some of the questions from the chat and
sure. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Colin.
Yeah, take absolutely.
Care. Thanks, Alice.
Take care. Colin, do you have a couple of minutes to stay and maybe we'll take a couple of questions from YouTube?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer questions. I don't want to talk about Alice sort of behind her back
absolutely.
And do anything like that. So if people want to ask me questions, they can have my point of view. But I don't want to like recap things in the debate just because that wouldn't be fair for Alice.
I want to just...
unchallenged.
I want to say to all of the CAIS and other DSD people who were talking about this on Twitter when I announced it, I am so sorry. This is exactly what they were worried about, that it would just all be discussion of intersex and that somehow it proves that sex doesn't exist. So very sorry. I really hope to speak to a CAIS individual soon.
All right. Well, thank you, everybody. This was the first time we've done this, but hopefully it won't be the last.
Indeed.
Hopefully, again, one of many. Thanks again. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Bye.